Hi, can you hear me? Fantastic. So
Yes, can
you
you hear
came on
me?
like a pro. So you said this is the first time that you've been on Instagram Live, is that right?
It is. I tend to stay away from social media. I'm
Ah,
extremely
okay.
introverted. So this is difficult for my
Well, this
system
is
right now.
exposure therapy live on Instagram, so fantastic. Firstly, Dr. Johnson, I would
Yeah.
like to say thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate you taking the time to answer questions from the community and just tell us a little bit about yourself and everything that you're doing for people with anxiety. Are you able to just start from the beginning? So, you work at the moment, are you dealing with people who are anxious? Have you seen it go up over the last few years? And what actually got you into to becoming a psychologist? Have you ever had your own struggles with anxiety, etc.?
Sure. So let me start with the beginning. I actually decided
Oh.
to be a psychologist when I was 12 years old. I'm kind of a strange cookie, in that way. And I think what led me to being a psychologist is, part of my story and my background is I grew up from in poverty. And so I saw a lot of people struggling in the day-to-day who likely had anxiety, had depression, had all of these undiagnosed conditions. And it just made me develop a strong care for the well-being of just everyday humans that are just doing their best in the world. And so I took it upon myself to say, like, I am aware of these problems. And at 12, I was like, I think I'm strong enough to like be able to help other people. And I actually wrote about it in my journal. I was very like putting on my cape of like, I'm gonna help people one day. And I dedicated my whole life from that point towards being a psychologist. So like everything was about doing well in school so that I could get into college because I grew up poor. I had to get like scholarships to go to college and do those sorts of things. And so, yeah, so over the course of my career, I really dedicated my time to, working with underserved populations, working with historically marginalized groups of people as well. And to your question about anxiety, yes. So many people have anxiety and depression. In the course of a person's lifespan, like 20% of all people are going to have anxiety or depression. So, yeah, every day of my life, I'm helping people with anxiety. And in terms of my own personal experience, I just mentioned that I'm introverted. And so, like, with introversion comes its own kind of anxieties about things. And so, yeah, before logging into this call, my heart rate like shot through the roof. And I was like, that's okay. Like, just center yourself. Like,
I think that's
so, yeah,
wonderful, isn't
absolutely.
it? A mental health professional showing that anxiety is just an emotion. It's when it's happening in a disorderly fashion that it becomes an issue. And I think a lot of people, and we get this in the community, and they almost say, how do I get rid of anxiety? How do I not get these physical sensations? And you understand if they're dealing with it on a daily basis, why they feel this way. But are you able to just give a brief explanation of why we need anxiety and how it can be useful to us, when it's not happening disorderly?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I conceptualize what you're saying is kind of that idea of, as a psychologist, I think about things being within normal limits. And so a certain amount of anxiety like makes sense. In fact, it's very adaptive. If a bear walked into here right now, I need that. I need that adrenaline rush. I need to like empty out my mind, empty out my system because it's time to go. Like, so there's parts of that that are like very adaptive, but if I'm having that experience just to go into a job interview, well, then now we're outside of kind of the normal limits or like what's adaptive for
No,
an
then that,
individual
yeah,
in a
I
moment.
couldn't have put it any better myself. Regarding a genetic component, do you believe that there is that genes do play a part with anxiety?
Absolutely. We know that like the biological components and genetic components of mental illness is there. We've done research on families and we see that these things like run in families. There's not always kind of like a one-to-one relation and that, like, you know, your dad could have depression and then you have anxiety, you know, but that the mental health like strain is kind of there. You also have to understand that people who struggle with their own mental illness, particularly when it's untreated, right? They're having all those cognitions and behaviors and those interpersonal interactions, which also kind of set people up to have certain deficits. So like if you grew up in a home, for instance, where you have the biological piece of this runs in my family, plus I'm living in an environment where people are engaging in a lot of unhealthy coping, and that's how I grow up, and that's what I'm learning.
Well, yeah, so it's definitely nature nurture, isn't it? So yeah, I believe there's not one specific gene, but I think it's a makeup of genes, isn't it? Where they're predetermined that you could have this vulnerability, let's say, to developing anxiety. But I completely agree with you, especially if you're dealing, if you're being brought up in environments with anxious parents and they're anxious, like you say, almost the parenting could be an anxious style. Well, this learned behavior can happen within adulthood, and I can really see that. I just want to get into some of the questions from the community. Now they've left lots of questions. So the first one is, do you believe there's a stigma surrounding medication for anxiety? And if so, why do you think that is? And what's your personal view on medication for anxiety?
Sure. So yeah, I think that there's a stigma about medication, but it's not exclusive to anxiety. In general, people don't like to take meds. you know, like that's just a fact. And I think it's even worse when we think about like mental health, because we tend to associate the mind with the self, and we associate the heart with our soul or our deeper connection to things. And so when people think about taking medication for anxiety, they think, well, I'm changing me as a person when I take this medication. We don't have the same mindset when it comes to physical health situations. So for instance, if you were to look at diabetes, for example, in diabetes, there can be an issue with your pituitary gland. So then you're taking medication to mitigate that pituitary malfunction. The same thing can be true for anxiety. You could have issues with having enough serotonin available in your system. So then you're taking medication to mitigate that. And so if we could have kind of more of an equal view of physical health and mental health, it would kind of change things if we could adopt that mindset that like by taking this medication, I'm not taking something because I'm broken or my personality is broken. I'm just treating a medical condition.
And that's serotonin, like you say, that's produced within the body, isn't it? It's just obviously these medications stopping the production so the body then harvests more serotonin, if that's right. And like you say, a lot of people worry, especially with antidepressants, that they change the mind, like you just mentioned, they change the self. But that's really, really not the case, is it? It's literally helping a process within you to better the serotonin production. Regarding medication, as in if someone comes to you with anxiety, is it a personal, is it an individual approach for each patient, or is it a first line treatment to go to medication, or do you always start with CBT therapy? How would it work?
Sure. I mean, for me, with the people that I see, you know, it's all about getting a full, thorough assessment about like what's going on with the person, you know, what is the etiology of this anxiety or whatever is going on with them? What treatments have they tried in the past? And then depending on the level of severity of their anxiety, that's kind of going to dictate what treatment looks like. There are many people with anxiety that don't need to take medication. If they commit to going to therapy and using the coping skills that they have, they will find that that is enough to manage. And there are other people where you just need that little bit of bio help. You need that like medication to just make the lifting a little less heavy.
I can really see how that's useful, especially for people who are in fight or flight almost like the second they wake up. I can see how medication can reduce that anxiety to then be able to better them to engage within CBT therapy, for example. I think for some people, it can lower that high level of anxiety to a more manageable where they can then do these skills. And like you say, medication, it may only be for a short period, it may be for however long, but I really like the individual approach on that. Do you believe that anxiety always has to have a root cause? Because I do hear within the community some therapists who are always delving to see, is there a root cause, or you have to find the root cause of anxiety, or it's always going to happen. What's your take on that?
I don't necessarily think that you always have to find the root cause of it. Sometimes certain things are obvious, and there are other things where you just don't know. And so sometimes I think about it like you've got a house that's on fire. You know, we can talk about what caused the fire, you know, or we can put the fire out. And so sometimes it's enough to just put the fire out. And if you don't figure out the exact cause of the fire, that's not necessary in terms of knowing what to do and what are the signs that a fire might get started.
I completely agree with that. The next question is, if a person feels they've exhausted all options such as therapy, medication, holistic approaches, what advice would you give them? So they feel like they've tried everything. What advice would you give this one person who's asked that?
Okay, so this is something that I get all the time. So the first thing I do is I go back to what I said about the assessment. And I want to go and I want to first explore what is this individual's expectations of treatment. Because at times what I find is that there are some people that when they tell me nothing works, what I find is that their expectation is that there will be something that will cure or eliminate the anxiety, which might not be the case. Depending on your starting point, there may never be like a 0 out of 10 for you, you know? And so when what I talk to my patients about is really that the goal of this treatment is to get your anxiety within what I call their zone of competence, meaning that the anxiety is not getting in the way of their daily functioning or getting in the way of them building the life that they want for themselves. And that really is the difference between like debilitating anxiety and like manageable anxiety. So if somebody shows up and they're like, well, I'm at a 10 out of 10 all the time, it's like, well, our goal might be to get you to a 5. And that might be the best we can do, which, you know, from the outside, you can think, oh, that sucks. But when you think about it, it's like 50% reduction in symptoms, that's a significant amount. So that's one of the first things I want to look at is like, what is this person's expectations? I think secondly, I want to fully assess, like I said earlier, every type of treatment that you've done, because what I find is that sometimes people have done incomplete courses of treatment. So for example, I'm an expert in DBT or dialectical behavior therapy. The number of times I have people come to my office and they're like, I've done DBT before and it doesn't work, you know? And then I talk to them and I say, really, like, tell me what you've done. What was your experience with DBT and all of that? And then I find out that what they thought was DBT wasn't actually, you know, like DBT. They might tell me, oh, I went to the group classes for a few weeks. And I'm like, yeah, the group classes are a part of DBT, but they're not the full thing. You know, so here is this person walking around thinking that they've done this treatment and they haven't actually done the treatment. I also have situations too where, you know, you brought, like holistic methods. Sometimes people will try a holistic method for a couple of weeks and they're like, oh, it didn't happen. And they didn't get the immediate outcome. But I'm like, it'll probably take you 3 months or 6 months of doing this consistently to see like a significant change. You've got to stick with it a little bit longer. And in terms of medications too, I've worked in primary care psychology for a long time. So I've worked with primary care doctors and psychiatrists. And one of the things that I found is that sometimes I would get a person that would say, oh yeah, I took this medication 10 years ago and it didn't work for me at all. And then we try it today, medication works. You know, so I bring that up to say, like, it's sometimes the kind of timing or the circumstances for why something didn't work. And so sometimes going back and retrying some of the things that you've tried before, you will have a different experience of those things. And really when it comes to treatment, it's about getting the right combination. So you do have to have patience and persistence and compassion to really take your time to figure out the exact
combo. For people who don't know what DBT is, are you able to just give a brief explanation?
Sure. DBT was a therapy that was originally developed by Marsha Linehan for the treatment of borderline personality disorders. But since that time, it's been found to be effective for depression, anxiety, PTSD, eating disorders, mm-hmm. anger issues, just a lot of different things. And so DBT, standard DBT, what that looks like when I mentioned like the full DBT, to do one full course of DBT is usually 1 year. And that includes 1 year of individual DBT therapy and also 1 year of doing DBT skills training as well. Another component of DBT is also phone coaching. So your therapist is kind of, you have access to your therapist. So like, if you're in the moment having a panic attack, you can call your therapist and say, hey, what skill should I use right now? And, you know, I can get on the phone and say, oh, we really want to use the tip skill right now for this, and kind of walk them through how to
Brilliant.
Do the
and
tip skill.
Regarding DBT and CBT, can they both be used together? Or would you go one over the other when you're treating someone?
Sure. So technically speaking, DBT is a CBT treatment. It's under the like broader umbrella of CBT. One of the differences between CBT and DBT is DBT tends to be more emotion focused than cognitive behavioral therapy, which focuses more on your cognitions and beliefs. Another thing that's unique to DBT is DBT added the addition of mindfulness. At the time when DBT was originally developed, mindfulness practices weren't happening in the West the way that they are now. Now everybody feels like they're a mindfulness practitioner, but like back in the day, that was not the case. And so the mindfulness components and more of the focus on emotions is a big piece of it. And there's also some kind of philosophical differences in terms of building the dialectic and non-judgmental.
I believe mindfulness is such a powerful tool now, especially when it's addressed, when people are using it correctly, because you're literally showing the body that the anxiety is there and not engaging with the anxiety, and showing that if you stay in the same situation and don't leave, for example, if you're having a panic attack, the body can cope. Because a lot of people, when they have a panic attack, they'll leave that situation, and that wrongly tells the brain, doesn't it, that that situation was dangerous. And that's where we can have a habit of avoiding those situations, and it can really take us down a spiral, Kai. And some people can develop agoraphobia where they find it hard to leave the house.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think when we start acting on our mental illness, it really paints us into a corner. We lose all quality of life. Something that I tell my patients all the time is that like emotions talk a big game, but they're not actually stronger than you. Like they're a part of you. And so they'll spike up and they'll make you feel overwhelmed. But if you can use some of your coping strategies, and mindfulness is a big one, can I sit with this emotion? Can I ride the wave, as we talk about, of the emotion, and you'll see the edges of it. And I find that that is one of the most terrifying things, is when you're kind of like on the up on the like roller coaster, you're like, when is it going to stop? Like, is it just going to keep going up? But if you can use your mindfulness skills to help you, you will notice like, oh wait, it's cresting. It's starting to come. And now you know your limit. And a big part of anxiety is uncertainty. So actually waiting it out and feeling that limit remove some of that uncertainty for you, even though it's
Yeah, and it's always and the body doing its job, isn't it? But it always tricks you to think maybe this time it's not anxiety, maybe this time it's dangerous. And I know a lot of people who say, yes, I can sit with the physical sensations. I can sit with the heart racing. I can sit with the uncomfortable feeling, the impending doom. But when it comes to derealization and depersonalization, where they feel like they're almost having this outer body experience, or almost like they're on a different level of consciousness, How do you help those people who believe that they can't sit with that?
You know, for people that I have that dissociate a lot, and I mean, this is true for everyone, but particularly when you dissociate, it's not just about what you do in the moment. It's about what you do on your day to day, you know, because really what we're trying to do is we want to expand your window of tolerance so that you're less likely to dissociate over time. And a lot of that has to do with these little mini exposures that we talk about. But also just like, what are my coping skills on the day to day? Do I sleep well? Do I eat well? Like, do I exercise? You know, do I have fun with my friends? Like, do yoga? Like, whatever it is. These day to day things really help a lot in keeping us more grounded and connected and keeping us from like just always being on that edge. There are some people that struggle with anxiety and dissociation where like, if this is the edge, they're like right here all the time. So like, it doesn't take much to like put you over. And I'm like, if you do these daily things, what happens is you push yourself down to where it'll take a while before you get to that edge. And so that piece is really important. And I would say just don't minimize the fundamentals. When I bring up things like diet and exercise and sleep, people roll their eyes at me. But then when I ask them, are they doing these things? It's always a no. And it's like, well, go do that. And then we'll come back and we'll see what's left over. You know what I mean? But we
so
have
what
to get a
do you say to them people who say, well, 3 months ago, I was eating what I wanted. I was eating fast food. I could go to bed 3 o'clock and then wake up at 7 and I was functioning. Why now, 3 months later, do I have to put all these things in place and almost change my whole lifestyle just to almost feel like I'm coping with the anxiety? What would you say to them people?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is like, think about this functionally, like think about the stress that you put on your body when you're lethargic and you don't eat well. It's funny, I was having a session with a patient and I even disclosed that like, you know, I can tell like when I eat crappy for like a week, let's say I'm eating nothing but McDonald's and like vegetable who, like that's not, you know. It's like, well, then now I'm feeling sluggish. Like all of these things are happening. And it's like, well, because I didn't give my body what my body needed. Like in order to like for my brain to create all these new pathways, like all of that, like it needs nutrients. And so everybody can like deal with that like stress for a certain amount of time. Also, when you're younger, you can deal with more damage than like you can do when you're older. When I was 12, I could fall off a building and pop up and just walk home like no problem. Nowadays, I step on a crack in the sidewalk and now my ankle is sprained. And like, I can't work out for 3 weeks. So I think part of it is like, you have to have compassion for your body and that your body is working really hard. And like when you don't give it what it needs, eventually it's going to break down and not be able to give you what you expect.
I completely agree 100%. The next question is, there's lots of talk in the mental health communities that anxiety is a natural response and it's not dangerous. Is it true if we don't address anxiety issues that over a prolonged period of time, this can start to have a negative impact on our physical health?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I think this goes back to what I was talking about several minutes ago about like within natural limits or within normal limits. And that, you know, when we talk about things like anxiety or depression or whatever, like, these are normal reactions to stimuli in our environment. If my cat dies, it makes sense that I'm sad. It makes sense that I might even be a little depressed for a period of time. You know, if I have a job interview, it makes sense that I would be a little anxious in that situation. So yeah, there is the basis of this is natural. It's a natural response. You know, an example that I use a lot of times with this, like, relates to height. I'll use a metaphor, right? And so for instance, I'm a cisgendered female. You know, for a cisgendered female, the average height is 5'4". I'm 5'10". You know, so am I tall? Yeah, but I'm within normal limits. Nobody's stopping in the street and gawking at me, you know? But if I were 7'5", it would be a different story. I would have people sneaking photos, you know, of me in that situation. Well, here's something that's true about size. People who are taller, or people who we consider to be giants, if you know of like Andre the Giant the WWF and the Princess Bride, well, people who are really tall, they have more health problems and they die sooner because it's more difficult for your system to take care of something of that size. The same thing is true for your anxiety. Think about what is happening in your body when you're at a heightened state 24/7. The amount of stress that puts on your brain, on your heart, on your organs, on all of these things. At some point, you're going to have physical issues that come up. And we know from research that people with mental illness have poor quality of life and health outcomes and all of that sort of thing. And some of it goes with the biological piece of just the stress on the body of being in that heightened state. But it also comes into terms of what I mentioned earlier with people who have mental illness, they're less likely to exercise. They're more likely to eat poorly. They smoke more. They avoid going to the doctor. You know, like there's all these things that mean that you're going to have poor health outcomes in the future. So like, absolutely. Like if you have a showstopper level of anxiety, you should be taking care of it. If you're similar to me, where you're just kind of 5'10", or you're just kind of introverted and it's within normal limits, that doesn't mean that you do nothing. But does that mean that like I have to be in weekly therapy? It's not a necessity. Yeah. It'd probably be beneficial, you know? And I have to use some of the same coping skills as the ones I give my patients because
that's wonderful. And I know what I'm just trying to think of what people would say in the community. I know that some might worry then, saying, well, I deal with anxiety all the time. Now I'm worried that it's going to make me physically unwell. But I think what you're saying is that it has to be addressed, and when it's addressed, it's highly manageable and highly treatable. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, just how treatable anxiety is.
Well, yes, it's 100% treatable. And one of the things you just said is that like my anxiety is going to make me physically ill. Your anxiety doesn't have the power to do that. Okay. Like, so can the anxiety stop you from like getting up and going to the gym? Technically, no. What it can do is create an action urge inside of you. So it can encourage you to not go to the gym, but it can't physically stop you from doing it. If you made up your mind and you were like, screw you, anxiety, I'm going to the gym today. It can do all of this stuff to like mess with you, but it can't physically stop you from doing it. So the things that I said about like people with mental illness smoke more, they don't go to the doctor, all of those things, it's like you have control over that. Anxiety, and I would say mental illness in general, it's like the Wizard of Oz and the guy behind the curtain where it tricks you. It tricks you into thinking that it is magical and all powerful and like you just have to obey. And I'm always the first one to tell my patients that's BS. And when your anxiety talks to you, talk right back to it. And you tell it, I'm not having it. Like, I'm not doing that today, because the anxiety does not have your best interest in mind. Emotions are self-serving. My depression is never going to tell me to go out into the sunshine. It's not going to tell me to pick up the phone call from my best friend, because your depression, your anxiety, whatever it is, it's totally selfish. So don't
love that. And when you do go toe-to-toe with the anxiety, like you said, you start to see the cracks. You see that, well, it doesn't hold this magical spell over me. Maybe it is me that's avoiding this. Maybe it is me that's holding back. And like you say, when you go toe to toe with it, it's almost like a magician. And then when you know the trick, it's not as magical, is it? So when you know anxiety, the psychoeducation is so important. And then going toe to toe with it, leaning into the uncertainty, you realize, well, anxiety does have this course. Yes, it may go up, it may come down and then shoot back up again, but it always passes through the body.
Yes, and another little point I'll add to that too is, once you go toe-to-toe and you start realizing you can win, your anxiety will try to change its tactics a little bit. And what I mean by that is that, like, if normally what you got anxious about was social interactions, and now, like, you've worked on that, the health thing will come up, and then it'll get you really anxious about health. But I'm originally from South Carolina, or the South, in the U.S., for those of you who are not from the States. And a saying that we have is, a pig in a dress is still a pig. So just because the anxiety puts on a different dress, it's not a different thing. It's still a pig. And so you just...
What is it that makes that shift? So like you say, someone's got social anxiety, they're going out, they're able to speak in the groups, but then they have this physical symptom, then they spiral it into a health anxiety. Why does it shift? Why do we get them shifts when people are going toe-to-toe?
Well, I mean, in some ways, I like to personify the anxiety a little bit. And I think in terms of, like, the anxiety wants to live, okay? And the more you manage it, the more you put it in a box, okay? So the same way that the anxiety tried to put you in a box, now you're putting the anxiety in a box, and it doesn't like that. The same way that you didn't like being put in a box. And so it'll say, like, okay, well, that didn't work. Let me scoot over here and see if that'll work. And guess what? If you start to engage with it again, it's like, yes, got her. And, like, now it's going to mess with you on that side. And so what I find is, you usually have to go through that process a couple of times, and then that'll start to die down.
Completely agree. Well. So I've got two more questions from the community. I'll fire through with them. The first one, I am 60-year-old. Who's dealt with anxiety for over 40 years. Would you say it's too late for me to recover? No.
No. And I almost don't even want to say anything else, because it's such a strong no. You can make these changes at any time. Your brain is capable of making these changes. There are processes that are going to be just a little slower, just like with age or whatever, but, like, you can still make all the same changes. I hate this rhetoric that, like, everything has to happen by the time you're 29, and then after that, like, the rest of your life is over. That's untrue. If you decided at 60 that you wanted to take up ballet, would you end up on a New York City stage? No, but it doesn't stop you from putting on a tutu and having a good time. It is never too late to, like, recover.
And I would probably say, similar to what you said earlier when you said about people's expectations, they said they've been dealing with 40 years of anxiety. Is it 40 years of constant fight or flight? I would guess to say no. I reckon that within they've had some moments that were lesser anxiety. So managing expectations, and like you say, it is never too late to take a different angle on your mental health, is it? The last question from the community is, I have parents that don't want to address my anxiety, even though it's clear I'm struggling with it. What options do I have?
Yeah, you know, that's really complicated, because if we're talking about a minor, technically speaking, you have to be a certain age before you can consent to treatment. So, like, if this person is, like, 14, you know, they really have to get, like, a legal guardian on board. But in many states, at least here in the U.S., at the age of 16 or 17 in most states, then you can start to legally consent for treatment for yourself. And so that's something that I think people should know. I would say also, you know, look for local mental health organizations. NAMI is a national organization that we have here in the States. And a lot of times organizations like that will have support groups that meet once a month, twice a month, weekly. It depends on the organization. And there's also a lot of online supports too. And so I would just say, you know, if you don't have access to, you know, traditional mental health at this point, don't, you know, freak out. What do you have available to you? Like, start doing all of those things. And then the moment you turn 18 and you can go do it yourself, do it. Or two, like, sometimes, you know, parents don't want to pay for stuff. You might even say, like, hey, I will take my allowance. Like, I'm feeling bad enough that, like, if you will let me go, I will take my allowance and I'll pay.
And why you say psychoeducation, I remember the first time, so years and years ago, the first time I had anxiety, what happened was I went to the doctors and they prescribed a library book. And at first I thought, why are they doing that? They're dismissing me. I think there's all these things wrong with me. They're not taking me seriously. However, fast forward a month later, once I've read and understood the whole anxiety process, the physical sensations, what they are, why they happen, the reasons why I'm avoiding situations, and it's continuing this cycle, that was the game changer, and it really kick-started my recovery. So psychoeducation, this is one of the things that I'm so strong at advocating. I want it in schools as early as possible, as people can read, because we can read about the anxiety and mental health conditions and learn these skills as well, CBT, DBT, for example.
I totally agree with you. There's so many necessary life skills that we don't get taught in school. And I think emotional regulation, to your point, is like one of those. And yeah, even like basic stuff like finances. It's like, can you teach me like how to be an adult human being? That'd be great. I don't need algebra 12. I need to know how to deal with
No, that's wonderful. Anxiety. And thank you so much for your answers. It's been absolutely a pleasure speaking to you, and I know the community is going to take so much from your answers. So if they don't follow you already, where can they find you on Instagram? Also, if they do, you do online treatment, or is it just people in the US, or do you cater for people worldwide? How can people come and see the services you offer?
Sure. Yeah, and so on Instagram, we're called Kind Mind Psych. I own a group practice called Kind Mind Psychology. And so myself, and I also have a team of therapists that are there as well. And for therapy, we only see people in the US, so like in states of like New York, New Jersey, and those sorts of things. But I also personally provide like life coaching, relationship coaching, and that sort of thing. And so I see people from all over. I'm also the host of a mental health podcast called Savvy Psychologist, where you can get quick tips on how to manage.
That's available everywhere where podcasts are available, right? Yeah.
Everywhere, Apple, Spotify, all of those.
Thank you so much again for stopping by with the community, and I wish you all the best for the rest of your day. No problem. Take care. Look after yourself.